send hype one similar to a device called NetHopper?
No, a NetHopper is something related but different. A NetHopper is a terminal server with a router in it. And NetRover, or what was it called, originally was done by Telebit, was the first one, a NetBlazer, and then NetHopper was Rockwell's knockoff. And it's basically serial lines with a router. And it's async. It's a router and it's async serial lines. So you'd hook modems on it to dial up. Again, though, if I just list for you all these, we'll be here till 5 o'clock. The point is there are a million of these kind of devices out there. What I'm trying to do is orient you so when you see one and you ask yourself that question, you can figure out the answer yourself. And what you're looking for is people are making combo pieces where they put routers along with interfaces. And that's all these things are. The other thing I want to do is demystify for you ISDN. It ain't anything but a funny phone line. It doesn't change anything. The fact that you hooked up ISDN just made your 28K modem into a 64K or 128K modem. It didn't get mysterious and change things. And I see this a lot when people say, I go to a T1 line or I go to an ISDN line or go to frame relay. What's different? And they start to see it different in terms of being a different kind of functional block. They start to think it acts differently, that it does different things. All it does is go faster or slower. Anything from a 300 baud modem to an E1 2 megabit line is no different except for speed. It's a bigger pipe. And so when you put these blocks together, by drawing this diagram I'm trying to show you, I'm using ISDN for every connection in here, but I could easily take this ISDN adapter away and make that a T1 line and make that a CSU-DSU. And what did I change? The pipe. And what did I have to worry about changing? I had to worry about who I bought the T1 line for, and instead of buying an ISDN adapter, I bought a CSU-DSU. Here I changed a dial-up line from a modem to an async ISDN dial-up. What did I have to worry about? Instead of a modem, I bought an ISDN adapter and plugged it into an async port somewhere on a terminal server that fed a router. These are building blocks. And all you're doing is arranging your tinker toys, and you have to have the right kind of building blocks hooked together. And the iPad happens to be a collection of commonly needed building blocks. Yes?
I'm not sure if you're going to touch on this or not, but I live in the T-world, and on the internet, I get it through AATS, but on my voice side, it's all on
the... We're going to get to that in just a minute. Hang with me. We're in the ISDN part right now. Yes? Yes.
I just have a simple question. Is there any loss in performance from the full T1 to APRI ISDN?
Absolutely not. Except that because you're ISDN, you're looking a lot more like a frame relay circuit. You've got the latency. But it's not real bad at those speeds. Your fixed latency on an ISDN is about 20 milliseconds. And on a true flat T1 line, it'll be about 4 milliseconds. Right now, phone companies are desperately trying to keep ISDN PR lines more expensive than T1 voice lines because they know what's going to happen when it flips over on them. They're going to lose all their good business. It's all going to rush to ISDN. That's why ISDN's taken so long to deploy. It's one of those political comments you get to pick up in here. It's a totally non-technical reason why it's priced the way it is.
Same wire, right?
It's the same wire. There's not an electrical difference anywhere in it. It's what software is on each end. That's all that's different.
By the time they get ISDN,
well, that's unlikely. But
what about the new talking about US West testing local T1?
Yeah, I don't want to distract this discussion with that. I'll have it with you offline. We're behind in this class already. We could do an hour on that. Anything that's new and coming, you don't need to worry about. Because you're not going to live long enough to use it. if it comes from a phone company. And your decisions today will be made on what you can buy today. And what you can buy today won't change tomorrow enough to make a difference. And by tomorrow, I would say safely within a 5-year period. Every new technology will roll out in the following sequence. First, you'll hear it talked about a lot. You'll read about it everywhere. Then it'll kind of quiet down. And then you'll hear about how TCI and US West have gotten together to do a pilot project, and they're going to roll this out. Boy, this is really it. And 18 people will get to see it. And then, finally, you'll get to hear it's for sale. You can order it now. And if you call and order it, they'll tell you, well, we'll put you on a list. And then finally, you'll be sure everybody's got it, because all the pilot project people will now spend a year telling you how cool it was. And you'll call back and say, did I miss it? Can I order it now? I say, oh yeah, you can order it now. Okay, I'd like one. We can get it to you in a year. By the time you can say, I can order it now, and they say, okay, we'll put it in 2 months, 5 years will go by. Guaranteed. And that's assuming that it was the right technology, it was absolutely perfect, and adopted as fast as it could be. So anyway, now we go to leased lines. These are your long-distance, permanent point-to-point connections. The adapters there are called CSU-DSUs, which stands for Customer Service Unit, Digital Service Unit. Here's two T1 CSU-DSUs. This is a tie link, this is an ADTRAN. Starting to see some physical similarity between modems, ISDN adapters. There's not a modem on this table, except in this rack. Those are the only modems on the table. But everything sort of looks that way because that's the job it's doing. It's just different electrical circuits it's hooking up to. And of course, nothing should ever have the same name. So adapters for ISDN, CSU-DSUs for leased lines. There really are two technologies of leased lines you will always run into. Whether you're buying frame relay, whether you're buying, whatever you're buying, it's going to come in your wire and your building is going to be one of these two things. A DS0 or a DS1T1. These are two terms for the same thing, because if it only had one name, you couldn't be confused easily. But DS1 and T1 are two names for the same thing, DS0. Point-to-point versus frame relay versus ISDN, PRIs, does not change the actual wire used to your location. For your purposes, I can make this simplification and you won't find out that there's anything but experimental ways to get out of it. You're always going to have a DS0 or a DS1 wire. You need to obtain the correct CSU-DSU. A DS0 wire takes a different CSU-DSU than a DS1 wire. So you have to make the correct choice of what CSU-DSU you buy. Fractional T1, same wire. There is no electrical difference. We'll get into what that's all about in a minute. And then you choose the configuration of your line. Yes? I don't know of any that do both DS0 and DS1 in the same CSU-DSU. I'm unaware. The technologies are completely different. I don't know that anyone ever built a combined unit because I don't think there's any economic drive to do so. I'm not going to swear there's not one, but I've never seen one. Yes?
Eastern Research has a box out that has both benefits and a box, but they are separate.
Yeah. Okay. Basically, you're buying both. They just put them in one cabinet. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
A DS0 is an analog 64K BPS channel. This is sort of the basic telephone company since they put in SS7 signaling. This is like the basic thing that all phones are built with is the 64K channel. And a DS0 is really an analog delivery of one 64K channel. It's normally set up with a framing that lets you use 56K of it. in newer switches and newer installations, you can get what's called a clear channel DS0 and use all 64K for data. This is not always available. In a lot of places, the phone company just never put it in. So this is what's typically called your 56K line. So if you go get a 56K leased line, what you got was a DS0, and if you're really lucky, you can maybe get 64K out of it if they can, if they'll let you get a clear channel version of it. A lot of times ISDN's cheaper, it's always slower. More latency in ISDN than a DS0. DS0 has about 8 milliseconds latency, ISDN has about 20 milliseconds. Speed's the same, 64K. DS1 or T1 technology is RF technology using T carrier to transport data. This is what makes this technology originally very tricky. Now it's getting a lot more calmed down and a lot more better technology. It used to be very, very goosey technology to put in. Today it's getting pretty well understood. They need to put a repeater in the line roughly every half mile if they have enough wire gauge. If they're in one of the lucky places where it was put in with smaller gauge wire, they can have to have them as close together as every 600 feet. So you're buying a lot of pieces to a T1 line if it goes any distance. A T1 line is 1.544 megabits divided into 24 individual 64K channels. And the way that you get a particular speed out of this line is your CSU, DSU at each end aggregates these channels together by putting one bit down one, the next bit down another, and pulls them together into a framing structure that goes up to 1.544 megabits at full speed, or you can have any 64K chunk of that for a speed that you want by programming which channels you use for data and leaving the rest out. When you use less than all 24 channels, it is a fractional T1. This brings up why the wire is no different on a fractional T1. The only thing that's different is the switch settings on the ends of the wire. There's nothing else about a fractional T1 that's different than a full T1. This is why you can buy a fractional T1 circuit and then upgrade it to a faster circuit by throwing the switches on your end and convincing the guy on the other end to throw his. Leased line provisioning. Provisioning means configuration, except telephone company people don't know this word. Okay. Back to my story of trying to keep your terminology straight. There are a lot of different pieces, but worse than that, some of the pieces have more than one name, and it's really the same piece, and I'm really trying to straighten that out for you in this class, too. Provisioning is just how telephone companies say configuration. Think of it as a different language in translate. CSU, DSU on each end must be properly configured. Telco must also properly configure any repeaters that lie in your leased line. Each repeater is individually provisioned or configured. Configuration at many points is separate for each direction. This is key when you're troubleshooting. You can have a T1 line that has data with no error flow in one direction and just can't get data to go the other way without errors. You're not crazy, even though they'll tell you you are, because that's the first thing they tell you when you call, just that, hello, you're crazy, what's the problem? And the thing is that you have to realize that the T carrier circuitry is built in one direction only. So when you have a T1, you really have two circuits, one to go that way and one to come back. And it can be broken in one direction and not the other very easily. Absolutely. T carrier provisioning options, or configuration choices, whichever way you want to look at it. Data encoding format. T-CAT channels are built for synchronous data. Because of that, the point of the channel is to get as many of your data bits to be data bits and to have to add as few extra bits between your bits as possible to get the speed as high as it can be. One of the problems with synchronous data is synchronous data derives its understanding of the clock speed from watching the data. Because you have a clock at your end, the other end has a clock, they're never going to stay together. They're always going to kind of drift away from each other. So because we're just the only thing we've got to clock it with, we don't have start bits, we don't have stop bits, we don't have anything we know about except the data itself. It's looking for changes from ones to zeros, and every time it sees an edge, it says, okay, that was a clock. That's where clocks are, it's where those edges are. Problem happens, however. Sometimes your data doesn't change. It goes to zero and stays there, or it's a bunch of ones in a row. And the wire electrically goes there and sits. And if it does it for a long time, what happens? The clock on this end has no clue where the clock is anymore, because there were no edges. So they invent things to do to stick edges in that you don't. If your data starts to get to not be the kind of data they like, they'll start just saying, okay, I got certain patterns that'll never go down this line. So I'm going to stick them in, and the other end, when he sees them, will take them and drop them out, but he will have seen clocks. There's a couple of choices for that. AMI. Brutally efficient pattern. You can't go hardly a lick without there being a clock change. The clock on the other end can be really sloppy, like, say, one that was built in 1970s technology. And it can see that clock and see that edge and never miss. Now, what do you think probably happens as a result? To make something that solid, they're sticking more secret bits in on you when your data looks funny. Your data has a lot more ways to offend them and make them have to fix it to make clocks happen. So it's a little bit slower. They stick more bits in that aren't yours, which effectively slows you down. B8SZ is a binary 8-bit zero suppress, for those who like to know what the letters mean. You don't need to know. Now you know, you can forget, and you're happy. B8SZS is what you have to know. That is a newer encoding technology that requires better circuitry on the ends to work. But of course, better means better by 1980s standards. Today, there's no circuitry you can make that's sloppy enough not to do it. It'll all work. Fewer bit insertions, can go longer without losing track of the clock, so it basically runs a little faster. So that's why, if you can choose, you should choose B8ZS. What happens is, and you brought this up with your ISDN and stuff, is the telephone company's been rolled out over a very long period of time. And there are places in the country where equipment has not been upgraded to be able to do this format, and you'll have to do this format. Because it's the only one they can give you. They just don't have equipment in place that'll do the newer one. That's data encoding. That's actually done on the bits in the bit stream to just make that bit pattern handle the clocking. Data framing format. Remember, there are these channels, all these channels, and we're sticking bits in different channels, and then at the other end we're pulling them back together. That's a framing. We're building a big frame that sits over the top of all these channels so we can stick all the bits back together in a pattern where we expect them to be. The original one was D4. And what D4 said was that I want to really know I got this frame right. And it takes an extra bit out of all the channels that's its own bit, that it puts its own patterns in, and if they don't come back that way, it knows it's bad. Just like the D4, it's a super check. It's really super reliable when the equipment was really goosey. Remember I told you, this technology, when it first was deployed, only barely worked. And that's because over the 70s and 80s, technology back then, it's really hard to build stable oscillators, to build stable edge detectors and things. Just technology wasn't what it is today. Once the technology got enough better, they said, you know, we can kind of drop that. We don't really need that. We can just check the data and do a simple CRC check on the frame, and that we're going to find any errors there are. It's really going to happen. And that's the extended superframe. Now, the reason it's called extended superframe is there was an intermediate step called superframe, but extended superframe is the one that's actually there today. An extended superframe takes all those bits they used to check the data and gives them back to you for your data. So if you have B8ZS and ESF, you'll really run 1.544 megabits down that line. If you have AMI D4, it's about 1.51, 1.52. You lose a couple hundred K out of the line. not like you lose everything in the universe and you don't want to fight to the death over this and, you know, like live on a farm in Montana until the FBI gets you to get the speed you want. But if you have a choice, you want this one. But it's not the end of the world if a phone company tells you you can't have it. You have to have the other one. Yes?
Now, can't you have the ATS
or all of these combinations are possible. But the truth is, you want this one, and if you can't have this one, you can't have that one either. Because the phone company equipment internally at the T-carrier level is either upgraded or it's not. And if it's not upgraded, you're going to get AMID4. And if it is upgraded, you can have any of the four combinations you want, of which there's only one you want. You want this one. So yes, you can, but you wouldn't really realistically pick that. There's not, as far as I know, any equipment out there that will let you have like B8ZS but won't let you have extended superframe. Maybe it exists, but I've not run into it. It's kind of either, it's old enough, you got to do this, or it's new enough, you can choose anything you want, in which case you'll do this. Yes?
On the, I have a piece of equipment that I can put all my keys coming to my switch.
Uh-huh.
And when I look at B8ZS for framing versus DNF, started on super
brain,
why are all the bits high on the network side?
Boy, I'm not sure. I'll talk to you about that out of class, okay? I think we're probably getting into a level of detail that, since we're a little bit behind, this probably is not the time for me to take the time to do it. I will talk to you about that offline, though. There is an answer. But we're getting pretty esoteric there.
Trust me, Phil, I won't understand.
The thing about these is, these are the ones you have to know. Because these are the things you're going to have to set up on your CSU DSU. That's why I've picked these parts of the T-carrier circuit to talk to you about. Because these are the parts you're going to have a switch over here that says B8ZS or AMI. And you're going to have to set it. And when you order a line, you need to know to ask to get this kind if you can. Because it's better if you can get it. They might. They're getting better. It could happen. It could happen. The third thing, after data encoding and data framing, the third thing is clock source. When your leased lines don't run, this is the third most common reason, is the clocks are wrong. There's three ways that clocks can be set up on CSU DSU. Internal, also called master. That means this CSU DSU is generating the clocks for both parts of the line in both directions. The clocks are coming from here. External. That means I'm expecting the other end to generate the clocks for both directions. Slave, also called loop, is your best choice. That says I'm generating it for one direction and I'm listening in the other. I generate clocks for what I send. I expect the other end to generate clocks for what he sends. Why is this the best choice? Because then if I set up all my CSUs the same way, they'll work on either end of the line. If I go master-slave, I set up one end internal, the other end external. Now, if I do that on all my lines, then I've got a show full of CSUs. I pull one down that's external and put it on this end. Suddenly, we have no clocks. They're both thinking the other end's doing it. Or I put two internals on. They're both generating clocks, and nobody's listening. No, clock source is totally based on your CSUs. The phone company will take your clocks and work them through. But the bottom line is, the truth is, if you just always say, I'm supposed to set it to slave, the times you'll be wrong will be minuscule. As a rule of thumb, just set your clocks to slave or loop mode. It's not 100%, but it's in the high 90s that you'll be right. The last thing about data that you get into on leased lines is, today, it's another one of these simplifications. If somebody wants to be picky, they can find me out on it, but you won't see it any other way. That is, if it's a synchronous line, it's going to use the HDLDC data format. And that's true if it's a PPP line or an SMDS line or a frame relay line. The basic underlying structure of the data that comes out of your CSU or goes into it is going to be HDLC. Some CSUs will discuss with you, should you do zero-byte insertion or deletion? I'm not going to explain to you what that is. some devices will ask you to configure it. Say, yes, I want to do that. Most common trouble areas you will encounter in a leased line. Incorrect provisioning. What's provisioning?
Configuration.
Don't be snowed when you hear this word. It's not tricky. It just means that's their switches instead of your switches. If you're provisioning, it's their switches. If you're configuring, it's your switches. Otherwise, it's the same activity. The effects can be subtle, because it can affect data in only one direction, while data is fine in the other direction. It can affect data with only certain bit patterns. Maybe that you put one test pattern down and it gets through the line fine, but a different pattern gets errors. When you start to see effects like that, when you see CRC errors being piled up in one direction but not at the other end, when you start seeing, well, I can ping and it's okay, but when I start sending general data, it kind of falls apart, probably have a provisioning problem. Almost certainly. Third one I put on here just because this one we have, Chris is over there smiling, we hit this one a lot. We had two customers whose lines didn't run for over 2 months because of this, and I finally had to get on the phone myself and badger the telco guy into a bet to make him check this. It wasn't easy. But we have seen, probably in 10% of our installations, we've seen this problem. And it's called they run a wire just a little bit too far. Or they run it through a bundle of cables where they picked one that really shouldn't have been a pair they used. For that last little piece between their network unit and the CSU. The way this works as a diagram and why this is an issue is as follows. Your CSU sits here and it has a transmit side and it has a receive side. And it goes all the way down the line to the other end, and that's this guy's receive side, and then this guy transmits. Now remember what I said, these lines are actually two completely separate lines. You really bought two circuits, one this way, one this way. They live right next to each other in the wires. Now, if you're sitting here, which of those signals is going to be the loudest? The one you're sending, or the one that's already come all this distance? At some point, if this one gets soft enough, it hears more of itself than the one it's sending. And there's a threshold there. As long as it's just above that threshold, everything works fine. And when this signal gets a little bit weaker and a little bit weaker, finally it gets just soft enough that the data from here scrambles this enough it can't understand it anymore. It's called crossover, it's called crosstalk, it's called a lot of things. Remembering this is an RF technology. It's a radio frequency in a wire. And that's why this is an issue for T1 lines. What happens is, only the telco can repair this. They can only repair it by changing the actual wires. They will resist it extremely. A line with this problem will pass most telco tests, including sending a guy out with a T-Bird to hook it up to the wire. Guaranteed it'll pass every test they've got. Here's, as a consumer, your tip. If you're talking with, by this time, you're going to be in deep. You're going to be on the line with a telco guy because your provider's a jerk and not making this get fixed. And you're the guy driving this one now because you're pissing everybody off. It's the only way to get anybody to pay attention. And you're on the line with some guy in the middle of the night who's the telco night guy, who's the first guy you're talking to, who really says, I'm here all night and my job's to fix this. You know, this is kind of interesting. I wonder what's wrong. You finally got to him. And he makes the magic statement to you. You know, I can loop your CSU, but I can't loop your DSU. I think maybe it's broken or set wrong. When you hear that, this is your problem guaranteed. he will be sure you're wrong. Badger him until he makes the test. And the only way they can test this is to change the wire. There is no other way for them to find out that's the problem. And that's why they don't want to do it, because they think you're telling them to change a wire and it's not going to make any difference. You can fix it with an inline repeater. You can do some things like that, but generally no, because normally this occurs between the LIU and the CSU and the last piece of the wiring that you had the phone company put in for you. So it's their responsibility.
What is the line
level? It's all based on signal level, and I don't know that there is one absolutely. It's based on the wire. Better wire, if you got a better set of pairs, it'll go farther. You can do all that, and you're absolutely correct that if you know this is your problem, there's a lot of ways you can solve it that aren't the one I said. But when you have this problem, I just told you how it's going to get fixed every time. It's not going to happen any other way in real life. We can create a lot of theoretical ways it should happen another way, but that's how it's going to go down.
That's the way it went down. On the flight out here, and yesterday morning, taking the repair guy there to the new smart cap program.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's
got T-Bird. T-Bird works great, doesn't it? Passes all those T-Bird tests, doesn't it?
And here, I said, please put a card in.
Yeah.
Put a card in, lost the air lights, I got my connection back.
That's exactly how it happens. Well, I'm telling you that not because I'm making it up. That's all I'll say. We've seen it a lot of times. Yes. Oh, so you're one of those guys who's my friend then? Because those are the great guys. Those are the guys who fix everything. Yeah.
They also have to keep it at work. You ask them what your return loss on the receive site does, and it's less, if it's more than 85 dB level, you're in trouble.
So if it's like minus 5.1 or a bigger minus number?
Yeah.
So now, the link of the straight, because this is good information for me too. You want to ask them, what is your return?
Yeah, you want your receive level to be more than 5.
Your return signal. And they're going to look at it at their end.
Yeah. The carrier's going out at the other end. He's going to receive it. He's not going to get it at a zero.
And that, okay.
And he's going to loop it back to you. And when you get it at your end, at the deeper, you don't want it more than a negative.
Okay, so when the guy's running, when he finally, because this you can get him to do, I say fairly easily. This is you have to understand this is sort of a calibrated fairly easily. You're in pretty deep and pretty frustrated by now, but you can get him to send a guy to your site to run a T-Bird test. And this is what we're talking about, is when we do that. So on your end, he's going to be running the T-Bird test, transmitting plus 16 and looking for his loop back return. And if his loop back return is a bigger negative number than minus 5, tell him that it doesn't matter if it passes the test. Is that what you're saying?
He'll tell you, oh, a neg 13 will pass, it'll work fine.
A neg 13 will pass, absolutely it will, but it won't run your CSU worth a damn. Okay. Well, I knew there was a threshold there, but I did not know what the numbers are, so this is good information. Okay. But anyway, I put that on this chart to alert you because you just heard it from a man who used to be the guy sitting in the field. It shouldn't be your problem, but it is. And you're going to be the one who drives the answer. Any other tips on how to get that to get checked or quicker? No, I'm just saying as a consumer. I'm a consumer on a phone. Is there anything I can say to make this more likely to get done quicker or addressed any earlier?
No, escalation.
It really is just what you're saying is you really just have to do it the way we've always done it, which we just escalate and get enough people pissed off, somebody will look. Okay. Okay. Well, anyway, that's leased lines, and with some understanding of what they are, you can get through one of your most frustrating problems, which is when you get your shiny leased line in and it doesn't work. Now, we're going to go to lunch here in just a little bit, and we should have they arranged to have the room open? going to have our phone room open because one of the other things I want to show you is what the network interface unit for a T1 looks like physically, so you know what it looks like, because there's a lot of just when you've seen something, somehow it's not as scary. And so during lunch, we'll let you go in here and take a look at this and see what it actually looks like when you get a T1 line in and what happens at the phone company end. I'm going to take questions, and then after lunch, we're going to start doing the fun part, I hope, which is the configuration and how we build things and how we set up stuff on the iPad and all that. Yes?
So you were talking about land bridge principle, and how it has internal routers.
Yes.
What do you think about the routing capabilities?
It's a router. Routers are, I mean, you know, I'm sure there are bad routers out there. There aren't too many that are, like, really crummy anymore. I mean, you know, They route fine. They're only routing two things. They're routing an Ethernet on one side and an ISDN line on the other. They have a pretty simple life. On the other hand, most of them, and this is true of most routers in general, and you'll see that with the Cisco, which is really probably one of the better ones is for this particular situation. Most routers are built to be configured by people who think spending their life configuring is fun, and if it gets done too quick, their fun is over. A Cisco is a lot better than most, and you'll see the difference between the Cisco and the iPad. This is one of the things in the iPad that I really want to stress. Don't think when you're programming routing on an iPad, you're living the life of most people who program routers. You will program routing on the iPad, and if you spent 5 minutes on it, it's because you spent 4 minutes checking it. And when you program routing on a Cisco, you're going to spend a lot of time at it if you're doing anything tricky. Just sorting it out. There's a couple of reasons for that. One is, I programmed a lot of routers before I created the configuration for the iPad, and I wanted to make the iPad be as easy as I could make it. More to the point, there's a lot of routing tricks that you want to do with subnets and breaking people's pieces off that are, maybe they're a little on the edge of legal, but you know they're okay. They should work. And a whole lot of routers simply will not let you do them, period. There's no way to program them to do them. Cisco is classic for that. There's a whole lot of subnetting structures you can create that a Cisco will simply not let you configure because it's technically illegal. And you'll just beat it and beat it, and it won't let you. For instance, it won't let you do three different subnets of different sizes. But there's nothing wrong with that. But it's convinced there is. The iPad checks only to say, can I figure out what you meant? And if I can, I'll do it. Even if it's wrong. And there's several people here who can testify to that. If you can give it enough of a hint that it knows what you meant, it will work. And if you want to do something, there's about five different ways to specify it. And if you get close to one of them, it'll say okay. It's been done to be the simplest, least demanding routing programming you ever knew. There's terminology about routing that you'll never have to know, even though you do it with an iPad. Things like IP unnumbered, a huge construct. It took Cisco about 8 years to develop, I think. I don't know. They had Cisco routers forever, and only the most recent ones will let you do it. And the way you do it, even when you know what you're doing, you get confused with the questions they ask you. I've got to link this to some other thing, and I've got to link this to that. And the answer is all that can be done by assumption on the router's part. There's no reason to make you have to say that. And so the iPad does not require you to say those things. It inherently will fall back to IP unnumbered. If you don't number an interface, it assumes you wanted to run it IP unnumbered on the host's network for you. You don't even have to know that that's a construct. It just does it. And there's a lot of things in routing with the iPad, and every single person I've ever talked to who had an iPad first, and that was their first device, and they learned to route and build networks with it, and then they reached a point where they had to use other routers, I get a phone call from every one of them that says, what is this piece of junk trying to get me to do? How do I make it do this? And literally, they're to the point where they can put an iPad. I had one CSI who went out and brought up a leased line by carrying an iPad out to the other end, plugging it in to prove it was all up and running, and it took him a week to take the iPad out and replace it with the equipment the customer wanted to do the same thing. And most of that was about routing. And so we're going to go through the configuration on the iPad first on routing, then we're going to bring a Cisco in to show you how it's done with other things. And they are the same thing. You're doing the same job, but it's nowhere near immediately obvious. And when you get into these LAN bridges, Ascend, for instance, which is the most popular one, I am convinced that a sadist wrote their configuration program. There is no possibility that he doesn't know and chuckle at night over all the people who are suffering trying to configure his device to do what it's supposed to do. It works, and it works well, but it doesn't work immediately. Is the lunch here?
12:30.
12:30? Okay.
On
leased lines, SMDS is yet another statistical multiplexing protocol like Frame Relay. Much higher quality, much higher caliber, a lot better. But as far as you're concerned, it's just another encapsulation protocol. And if you get it, that would be what it was. And view SMDS as a far more predictable frame relay. These are simplifications to people who know this technically, but I'm trying to get it in terms that you can really deal with. SMDS is rarely delivered to the end user premises, although in some cases it's starting to be. ATM is asynchronous transfer mode. That's a time division multiplex protocol that is suitable for gigabit networks and makes everything predictable, and they bury all the other protocols inside it. Today, really only rolled out on big backbone networks, and telephone companies are desperately hoping that there's a way to get it to happen at the RBOC levels and the CO levels and local levels without them having to tear down everything they've got and build it over again. So it'll roll out again unless you work in a large corporation with huge wide area network internal departments. You're never going to see ATM personally. It's all going to be part of what's behind the wall of the things you buy from the phone companies. SMDS, I would have said that about a year ago, but there's starting to be a few places, I think in California especially, a couple of others, where they'll let you get direct SMDS format connections to small premises. It's still not very common, and you won't run into it directly very often. But it's beginning to be something you might get a direct option to buy, so I can't say you'll never see it anymore. Yeah, point-to-point T1 is T-carrier technology from one end to the other. It's just a wire. Now, again, these wires can be buried in other technologies. Your wire might go out into a ATM cloud and come back out. You don't care if it's a T-carrier circuit. They're going to guarantee you that it acts and works just like that from end to end. They may put in a piece here and another piece here of a different technology and stick it all together because for them to build it, that's the easiest way for them to do it. If I got like a T1 from here to Chicago, say, it's almost certainly going to go into some big network and be multiplexed in and multiplexed out. And in that network, it may be running ATM for a little bit of the piece or something else. That's all intriguing, but for you, it's not a consideration. If you get a T1 line, it's a T1 line. It works like it. If it doesn't work like it, it's broken and they have to fix it. And you don't really care what's behind it. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Go ahead. Either. One of you. Okay, you. Question is, can you take a voice T1 and split it and use data over part of it? Absolutely. Remember, there is no such thing as a voice T1 or a data T1 or anything else. There's only two kinds of wires, DS0 and DS1. Everything is one of those wires. Everything that it does is based on what you plug into the ends of it and what software runs on it.
So the phone company is telling you a voice T1 is different than data T1.
Yeah, telephone company will tell you a voice T1 is different than a data T1, and it is, because one costs more. They're tariffed differently. But if you want to find out difference in electronics, you won't. Absolutely, you can buy channel banks that you can pull DS0s out of channels on TS1s and fractional T1s plus voice. Every combination is out there to buy. Everything you want to do, you can go get. It's just money. Yeah.
My question is, when we go to Utah, when we go from where we are in Aurora,
right? Yes.
Almost always go through the same sets of winds.
And that'll be common, and they'll change generally only when some fairly major change occurs at a backbone level in one of the, or another of the backbones.
Why do we get, you know, you go along and find, you know, when it happens, all of a sudden everything will stop at one.
That's one of those general questions where there could be 100 reasons. So it's not like I can say, okay, if that happens, it's always this thing. The point of this class, to some degree, and the time I've spent on this theory in the last couple days, is to give you the ammunition to start trying to say, well, it might be here, it might be there. No. In fact, in general, you will for great periods of time. Something about the network topology has to generally change for you not to. Yes, and that's because your service is through a provider that hooks to the links at that point. Or it's where you got your service from is a provider that's based in San Francisco. That's correct. What you're going to do is go from locally to Metropolitan Fiber through a Metropolitan Fiber backbone to San Francisco to their facility, and then their facility in San Francisco is where you'll enter the internet.